It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we speak with Senator Tammy Baldwin about some of the current challenges facing Wisconsin, from oil trains to avian flu.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Ovshinsky.
One of the biggest stories this week came out when the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau said there'd be no additional money over the next 2 years to help restore funding cuts to K-12 education or the UW system.
The Legislative Audit Bureau released a report today critical of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We find out why and what could happen next.
And the state's Joint Finance Committee continued voting on important budget items this week. We'll cover those stories now with WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here, Rob, and as always, happy Friday.
Happy Friday and busy Friday, busy all week, really, in state government news.
Very, very busy week.
We would have had Sean Johnson camped out in the studio with us if you'd let us. That's how busy a week it was.
You can't have him, sorry.
Well, so breaking news today now, something from the Legislative Audit Bureau.
Right. So they released an audit today, and it found that WEDIC, which is the state of Wisconsin's primary jobs creation agency, it found that it did not adequately keep track of what jobs were created or retained by companies receiving tax credits. The agency also found that WEDIC, the fund balance at the agency was larger than necessary and that it should be reduced. All in all, a pretty scathing report by the audit folks.
Now, WEDIC has been under fire on and off since its creation, really, right?
It has. This is not the first time WEDIC has been found to have broken state laws and really failed to follow its own rules. Almost since its creation in 2011, audits reporting by the Journal Sentinel and others have revealed that it is, you know, it's been doing a pretty bad job of keeping track of the tax credits and other incentives it hands out. You know, officials have repeatedly defended WEDIC, saying, you know, these audits pointed out old problems that had since been fixed. You know, but here we are again, another audit. And at least according to the Legislative Audit Bureau, more of the same.
This comes in the middle of the budget process. What's the reaction been from lawmakers, from the governor?
Well, this news comes at a really bad time for Governor Walker. You know, he proposed merging WEDIC with another jobs agency called WEDA in his budget. And just a few hours ago, in fact, he backed away from that plan and has pulled a proposal from his budget. Senator Rob Coles, who co-chairs the legislature's audit committee, called the findings unacceptable. So getting a
from the governor's own party there.
Yeah, from the governor's own party. So really, I think the reaction has been quite strong.
So any good news when it comes to WEDIC in this audit?
According to a statement by WEDIC officials, the audit did find that there was a significant decline in loan delinquency rates and that the agency provided a high level of customer service to businesses and other stakeholders. Officials, however, took issue with the findings we've been talking about. In the same statement, Chief Executive Officer Reed Hall said the agency strongly disagreed with the findings.
Okay, for those playing state agency bingo at home, that was the Legislative Audit Bureau. Let's move to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau now.
Right, so big news this week. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau dropped a bomb when they released their updated revenue estimates. The headline here being that they are predicting there will be no increase in state revenue. Republican lawmakers have said for months that they were expecting an increase in that money and that they would use that increase to offset cuts to the UW, K-12, and decrease bonding for road construction.
A lot of finger crossing going on there that this particular report was going to make the budget life a lot easier. So what does this mean for those cuts you were just talking about?
Well, lawmakers have said that they will find money for K-12 and that they are open to increasing car-related fees to raise money for roads.
So the money isn't there. This higher revenue isn't there. So how are they going to fill that those K-12 cuts?
Well, as far as K-12 is concerned, they are looking at using an accounting trick that actually Governor Walker himself has tried to move away from that essentially pushes a payment to the next fiscal year. It means schools still get the money they need, but increases the deficit as well at the same time.
So are people talking about any other sources of funding that could address that or the other cuts?
Well, Democrats, of course, have been quick to chime in with all of this, and they say that lawmakers should delay the full implementation of a manufacturing tax credit. They argue, and have done so for several weeks now, that the state should accept extra Medicaid money offered under Obamacare. you know, neither of those ideas are being really embraced by GOP lawmakers. But, you know, those are places where the state, you know, could find money if they wanted to.
Given all that news, a lot of eyes on what happens with the UW system. Any talk of trying to find similar money there, or are those cuts just going to stand?
Well, you know, they are now more likely to see the full $300 million cut or something close to it. You know, for weeks, the lawmakers, the governor had talked about, you know, if more money was going to come in, that they would use it to offset the cuts to UW. I think it's going to be much harder to do that now, now that revenues are going to be flat.
Talking to News Guide Noah Ovchinsky in our weekly roundup of news from around the state. Well, let's hit the Joint Finance Committee. They've been plugging away at this big document, the state budget. Some of the highlights, Noah.
They made some changes to the state parks this week. They went largely along the governor's budget proposal on this with some minor tweaks. They essentially zeroed out the financial support the state parks receive in the form of tax money and are shifting that cost to users. The takeaway being it's going to be a bit more expensive to use state parks in Wisconsin. Vehicle admission stickers will increase by $3 to $28. Campsites will go up about $2 a night. Annual trail passes will go up $5. Several other fees are going to increase as well.
And then officer-involved shootings, obviously all over the national news. There's a budget line that has to do with investigating those shootings in the state.
Yeah, so the JFC voted this week to add money for new investigators at the Department of Justice to handle police-involved deaths. A new state law, which we've talked about on the show, requires all police-involved deaths to be investigated by an outside party. And since it was passed, you know, the agency, the DOJ, has literally been flooded by requests from local police departments to investigate them. So much so, in fact, that Attorney General Brad Schimel asked for additional money. The governor did not include it in his budget proposal. The JFC, however, voted to fund four new positions. You know, making some progress on that front.
So this would be to implement the law that already exists, really, not new legislation.
No, I mean, to better implement the legislation, I guess, that already exists. They need more investigators to investigate these shootings. Now it looks like the DOJ is going to get a few more.
Now, a project in Eau Claire that people in that area of the state in particular have been watching closely, this Confluence project.
Right. So this is a mixed-use project that people have been talking about a lot for several years, actually, in Eau Claire. And the governor actually proposed giving the project $15 million in his budget, money that obviously the project needed. The JFC, however, citing the revenue estimates we just talked about, said basically the state can't afford it and took that $15 million earmark out of the budget.
Yeah, that's one they're going to be looking to fill, but it doesn't sound like it's going to come from the JFC at this point.
Not at this point, so they're going to have to find that money elsewhere.
All right, stepping away from the budget just a bit, here's one we've been following for a bit, higher speed limits on the way in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we are a big step closer this week to faster speed limits on Wisconsin highways and interstates. The Senate passed a bill increasing the speed limit to 70 miles per hour. The Assembly actually has already passed a version of the legislation. They just have to pass one that includes an amendment that was included in the Senate version. And then it's off to Governor Walker's desk. I'd say that this bill has a lot of momentum.
I'll pretend you didn't say that, Noah. But so this doesn't mean that all highways, when this is signed, suddenly go to 70. They'll then pick, like, designate areas of highways.
Exactly. Yeah, it'll be up to the state to really decide where they want to increase that speed limit.
And then looking ahead, this budget thing isn't done. Joint Finance is still going to be working on this into next week, probably beyond?
Yeah, it's not nearly over yet. The JFC is going to continue looking at this budget and will do so for several more weeks.
Noah, thanks a lot, as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovchinsky reviewing the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
On Wednesday, a train carrying crude oil in North Dakota derailed, caught fire, caused the evacuation of a small town. It was the fifth serious accident of its kind since the beginning of the year.
These oil-carrying trains passed through Wisconsin on their way from hydraulic fracturing operations in North Dakota to refineries on the East Coast. Senator Tammy Baldwin sees them as a threat to communities in the state and wants the oil transportation companies to share more information about their operations with the public.
Senator Baldwin joins us now. Senator Baldwin, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to join you. Thank you.
So you and a group of other senators wrote a letter on this asking for some things to change. First of all, how big a problem do you see these oil trains being here in Wisconsin?
I think it's a very serious issue here in Wisconsin. You know, just a few years ago, an oil train was a very rare sight in our state, but through the boom in North Dakota, we're seeing as many as 40 trains a week traverse our state through different routes. Many of these trains are carrying more than 100 tank cars filled with crude oil. And I have been hearing the alarm increase as people in communities see these trains coming through and learn about these derailments and explosions and events that are happening elsewhere and fear that it could occur in their community. So we've been taking a wide range of actions over the last couple of years, but the question you ask relates to a rule that was issued last week by the Department of Transportation relating to updating and modernizing the train cars that are being used to contain the crude oil. And my comments that these are inadequate, first of all, they're late. They were supposed to be promulgated at the beginning of the year. But secondly, a number of the more dangerous tank cars won't be phased out for many years, and some perhaps will be in use indefinitely under this rule and with its loopholes. And I just, given what we've witnessed elsewhere in the country, including nearby, I don't think it goes far enough and think our communities and citizens demand better.
So with the tank car issue in particular, what more would you like to see done?
Well, first of all, I think that the old model, which is referred to as the DOT 111, should be entirely eliminated from the fleet, if you will, for purposes of carrying crude oil. The replacement car has also been associated with explosions in a number of these recent derailments. And that's very disappointing, of course, because the freight rails were upgrading to this tank car in hopes that it would be a significant improvement over the DOT 111. What I think and what I believe strongly they need to do is have a sort of thermal liner, which has been shown to greatly decrease the likelihood of explosion. And so I think they should be required to upgrade to that safest level as soon as possible. But there's a couple of additional safety measures that could be applied that I think, as this phase-out occurs, would be helpful. One is, you know, there's no reason why this crude oil could not be treated so that it is actually less volatile in transit. There's a process for doing that. Right now they're doing that prior to refining rather than at its source. Secondly, some of the braking technology as well as train speed limits ought to be addressed in the meantime, especially when these trains travel through densely populated areas.
And you were also looking for more disclosure over the routes of these oil-carrying trains. Who do you want to have access to that information?
You know, first responders need to have training and information in order to be able to protect the public in the frightening event of a derailment and, potential for disclosure for explosion. Our first responders, this is sort of new to Wisconsin in just the past several years, and the specialized training to fight a crude oil fire is not necessarily something that all of our first responders have had the opportunity to get, and so that's a major issue. But they also, there ought to be a clearer way for our first responders to learn when an oil train is coming through or, what exactly, what hazardous material exactly a train is carrying in the event of derailment.
Now, you've called for public access to this information, too. Rail companies have objected, saying this is maybe a security risk. This might make these things security targets. Does that concern you?
Well, I hope that we can start either a negotiation or a conversation about how this information should be disclosed. You know, if it's considered classified and an accident happens, we're talking about sending first responders who are there to protect communities in without knowledge of what they're going to be fighting, what sort of chemicals may be being carried by a train. And that's, I think, the worst-case scenario, and especially if it's considered classified and then it takes, a long time to figure that out. We need to have our first responders ready. And so that's a combination of training and having access to timely information. Now, there are certainly ways to do that, I think, that can protect the public interest that we would all share. But right now, I don't think we're there.
Talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. So far, we've been talking about trains that carry oil. Going to switch gears now. Senator Baldwin, you also are looking for more funding for the agency that tracks and tests for this avian flu that's causing problems among poultry here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What are you looking to see change?
Well, right now, I think it's really critical that we stay on top of this spread of the avian flu. And part of what that means is that the labs that are able to do the testing to quickly identify affected farms and enable animal health officials to contain the virus, we have to make sure that these labs are able to continue doing that job at a very fast pace. We have two labs in Wisconsin that are contributing to solving this avian flu crisis. But right now, the labs are actually performing hundreds of tests daily, and they're working 7 days a week. They are at capacity. And so I think we need to be aware of the demands that we're placing on them and make sure that we keep up with this so we don't start lagging behind in fighting this. Now, the avian flu is having severe economic consequences throughout our state and in the poultry industry at large. And I just want to make sure that we have a strong response through the USDA and the National Animal Health Laboratory Network.
In our last few moments, Senator Baldwin, we've discussed on the show the VA Center in Toma, Wisconsin, investigated for overprescribing prescription drugs. I'll ask you in a minute about what's being done now about the situation. First, a former staffer of yours filed an ethics complaint against you and your office for what she called a political cover-up related to your office's receipt of a report on this. Did you or your staff violate ethics standards when you were tipped off on the overprescriptions or after the situation became public?
Absolutely not. First of all, I obviously am disappointed that this has become so politicized, because I think we should all be focused on the most important thing, which is to make sure that the men and women who have served our country get the best health care that they have earned and that they deserve. And that's what we're focused on. But with regard to the handling of a whistleblower who contacted our office, I have said publicly, and I say so again today, that I believe my staff mishandled the whistleblower. I have apologized. The mistakes made were mistakes, I think, that slowed down our full assault on the real problems that are happening at Toma, and I wish they hadn't happened. But we are going full speed ahead today.
And let's end in that point. What's the latest? What kind of changes are happening? Are they happening fast enough?
Well, I think all of us are frustrated that the investigations, there's several that are ongoing, are taking as long as they are. But I do think that we should be heartened that From my view, at least some of that delay is because they really are taking the time to talk to witnesses, to whistleblowers, to affected family members who my office and other congressional offices have tried to let the investigators be aware of so that they can understand these serious allegations that are being brought forward. So they're not unfolding as quickly as we would like, but we hope that they are going to be very thorough. And in the meantime, a number of the problems that we've seen in Toma require, I think, a legislative response. And I am working on a significant piece of legislation dealing with guidelines for VA prescribers of opioids, as well as additional empowerment of patients and families of patients to be voices in the quality of care that those patients are getting.
We'll watch for that legislation as this story moves ahead. Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about oil-carrying trains in Wisconsin and other challenges facing the state.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker.
It's Mother's Day this weekend, a time to maybe stop and listen to your mother. That's the name of a new book and national performance event that started here in Wisconsin, in Madison. Typically runs on or near Mother's Day weekend.
The show features the stories and voices of mothers and explores motherhood in all its guises. Anne Imig edited the collection of essays and contributed one of her own, too. She's the founder and national director of Listen to Your Mother, and she blogs at Anne's Rants. Anne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, your new book and the show, Listen to Your Mother, all began when you were home alone in the early days of your motherhood, and you had to fight off isolation, and you did it by blogging. What were those early days like?
Wow, those early days were like 20-minute segments that went on for decades, it felt like. My husband was traveling a lot back then, and I just took comfort in finding the humor for my day and just sharing it. And I had no idea when I started blogging that I was going to form these amazing connections with other parents and creative people. So that was a big surprise.
And were you surprised to find that you weren't as isolated as you thought, that there was this huge national and international community out there who wanted to be in on this with you?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, too, is I had a lot of support. I mean, I came back to Madison so I could be close to family and friends. And even so, even when you have the support that a person could need, just sort of the grind, the hours that go by, and especially those sort of sleepless hours in the middle of the night, they really are isolating, and it's hard to even articulate it. And so not only being able to have an outlet myself, but to discover so many other writers, having that kind of inspiration and input and validation just by reading other people's work, it was really thrilling and definitely made me feel like I was with a really big group of people going through the same thing.
And give us a little of the backstory here about how Listen to Your Mother, which is now, it's this performance event, it's a book, and it's a community. How did it all grow out of your early blog?
Well, I have a background in theater. In fact, I went to the UW-Madison and was in a lot of productions in the 90s. And so when I started writing, it was heavily influenced, I think, by my acting background. And I actually went to my first blogging convention called Blog Her in 2009, shortly after I started blogging. And the event there, which I really felt like I found my people, was a live stage reading event. It was really simple. It was just writers, bloggers reading their own writing from the page at a podium. And I found it so moving. And I was sitting there trying to sort of figure out how and why it was so moving, because it was so simple. And that's sort of what planted the seed And as a former performer myself, I really wanted to do that. And then a few months later, the timing was either a coincidence or completely, you know, destined, whatever you believe. But it was before Mother's Day, and I just thought, you know what? I feel like I want to do something in my real-life community. I want them to experience some of the creative vitality and peer support that I'm getting to experience online, but here in Madison. And I hosted auditions, and I could not believe the powerful stories that walked through the door. And about 300 people came to the Barrymore in 2010 for the first show on Mother's Day. And then I put the whole thing online. We had it videoed, and I put it online. And because I was really entrenched in this mom blogging world, I started to get requests from my blog friends wanting to do the show. And that's how it all started.
And it's become this national thing. Is it fair to call it a movement?
I think it is fair to call it a movement. We're in 39 cities this year, and it's both a live staged series and also a social media phenomenon because it's this grassroots project run by bloggers, 100 women around the country. And then we put all of the shows on YouTube. So we have a YouTube channel, LTYM Show, with over 1,000 stories of all different iterations, men, women, sons, daughters, moms, non-moms. And we'll be adding 500 more videos after this season. And it's a charitable giving mission. Each show gives 10% to a local cause supporting women and families in need. So I think it is fair to call it a movement.
Well, we're talking to Anne Imig right now about her new book of essays drawn from the performance event Listen to Your Mother. The book has the same title, and the book collects essays from on the national stage from these Listen to Your Mother events, and you open with one that I thought was incredibly poignant. It was really beautiful, I think, representative of what Listen to Your Mother does. It was about a mother who almost couldn't stand the closeness of her adult daughter. She was sort of overwhelmed. Can you tell us about that very first essay?
Oh, okay. So I think you're looking at a galley copy in which, are you talking about Orbits by Ruth Pennebaker? Is that the essay that you're looking at?
I believe so.
Yes. Okay. So Ruth Pennebaker is an amazing, talented writer. She's been based in Austin, and she writes this beautiful essay in which her adult daughter has asked her to tend to a wound on her back. And all of a sudden, Ruth is just transported because it's been years since, you know, she had to physically have contact with her daughter in that way. And she just is transported. And the Orbits title is about how when the children were little, they circled around the children, constantly tending to them. But that as they age, those circles get wider and wider until the kids sort of make circles around you that go farther and farther away. It makes me cry every time. It's beautifully written, and there's a lot of humor in it.
Yeah, there's a mixture of humor and sadness and joy running through all of these. There's one performance, so we've got a little bit of Rebecca Anderson Brown. Do you want to set up what this one is about?
Yeah, so Rebecca's local here in Madison, and she read an incredibly powerful story about mothering through depression, and she read it on stage here in Madison a couple of years ago, and it's just about her ongoing sort of battle to not only mother through their depression, but the knowledge that what a strong hereditary component this has, and how she's so vigilant, not only in monitoring herself, but watching her children. And it really, really ends in a place of strength. And that's what I love about the harder essays in the book and on stage. We go through some very sort of heart-wrenching content at times, but those are the stories that I feel like are like an outstretched palm to other people going through something similar.
Here's a little bit of that one from Rebecca Anderson Brown.
Martin Luther King Day, 2002. I sat huddled in the corner of my bedroom, sobbing, trying desperately to disappear, and my husband trying desperately to find something that would help me. I was terrified, swallowed up by darkness, hopelessness, utterly convinced that the baby growing inside me not only deserved better, but might not even make it, so thick and poisonous were my thoughts.
Rebecca Anderson Brown sharing some difficult things. There are things we don't often share with a lot of people, let alone hundreds of people and thousands more, you know, via the internet. What did it mean to people who heard her essay? How did they respond?
We call these moments Me Too moments. What often happens in the lobbies of our show is that people from the audience come in, have conversations with our readers, and they say, Me Too. And I went through that too, or I'm going through something similar. And so really these women and men who boldly get up on stage are really giving a great gift, because there's so many people, like you said, Veronica, who will never get up on stage and share their most deeply personal story. But it provides such a service, because people in the audience know that they're not alone, whatever it is they're going through.
And they're not all difficult moments. There's a lot of laughter. Your essay is really funny. If it's the same one that you've got in the final copy of the book,
My Children Ate My Gratitude.
Right. Tell us about that one.
Oh my gosh. Well, I wrote this essay a couple of years ago when I was working at my computer, and my son came to my office and he said, Mom, can I have one? And, you know, I look up thinking he's talking about potato chips or something, and there's nothing in his hands. And he's reaching into the silver box I keep on my desk, and I'm so confused, because what's in that silver box are tiny scraps of paper where, on my therapist's advice, I've been writing things that I'm grateful for, like practicing gratitude in an active way. And I said, Son, you know, that's paper. And he said, well, Max had one yesterday. So lo and behold, I find out my children have literally been eating my gratitude.
Yeah, they're eating. You phrase it funnily in the book that they're eating, you know, your friends, your girlfriends, and your husband, and Mark Ruffalo, and
the house cleaners, dry martinis. Yeah. They've already eaten everything out of the pantry and all my minutes and patience, and now they're eating all of my loved ones, you know, sliver by sliver.
What do you think people respond to so much in these essays? I mean, I guess one thing universal is everyone has a mother, but why do you think you seem to have hit this nerve where people wanted to really talk about it and reflect on it and celebrate it?
You know, I think there's a couple of different reasons. We've really built this project with intention that we want to hear all of it. That this isn't just like mothers are the most amazing, wonderful thing, which they are, but not everybody had that kind of relationship with their mother. Not everyone chooses to become a mother, and we really honor that and lift it up right along with the other stories. And I think it really is about nurturing, and we really recognize that almost everyone is called to put someone's needs before their own at some point in their life. But really, I think the biggest reason is something you already touched on, which is the isolation of modern motherhood. So many people do not live at home or even in their hometown. And, you know, the more we are in front of screens and disconnected from one another, the more profound it is to gather together in real life and be in the presence of these stories and people willing to be that outstretched palm.
We're talking about motherhood today in honor of Mother's Day, which is coming up this Sunday. Anne Ibbig is with us. She's the founder and national director of Listen to Your Mother. Her new book is called Listen to Your Mother, What She Said Then, What We're Saying Now.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your most powerful memory of your mother, or your most powerful memory from being a mother? What would you like to tell us in honor of Mother's Day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. With Mother's Day around the corner, we're celebrating with Anne Ibbig. She's the editor of the new essay collection, Listen to Your Mother, based on the national performance event, which started here in Madison. She also blogs at Anne's Rants.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen one of these Listen to Your Mother shows in person or online? How did it match your reality? And what memories of your mother stand out? What would you want to share with the world about your mom? Or if you are a mom, what do you want people to be thinking about on Mother's Day? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Anne, Jenny Lawson is another writer who appears in your book, and she writes about what she sees as what can be a judgmental culture around mothers, why it can be tough to be a mother. Let's take a listen to that one.
Becoming a parent subjects you to a whirlwind of new and strange emotions and can leave you feeling more vulnerable than you have ever been in your entire life. It is at this exact moment that you will find yourself set upon by strangers intent on telling you exactly how terrible you are as a parent. You might think that you will easily brush aside these criticisms as you are now a grown-up and you understand that you are master of your own destiny and that peer pressure is something you overcame in high school. But then you'll find yourself in tears because someone said your child will become a drug addict because you once got an epidural. Or that you should be forcibly sterilized because you put your kid on a leash. That last one there, not a joke. That totally happened to me.
And what you don't hear there is Jenny Lawson explaining that the reason her child is in her Elmo halter is because she has a condition where if her mother holds her hand and the daughter trips, that her joints dislocate really easily, and then she'll have a screaming child who needs to get a dislocated joint put back in, so she uses this harness. I think that's what's part of what draws people, like you said, is this Me Too factor, that it's not something you have to keep in if you're not having an easy time. You can get it out there and get some comfort.
I think so, too.
What do you think about how people responded to that one by Jenny Lawson?
Well, Jenny, that essay is absolutely hysterically funny. Nearly every interviewer mentions that essay because it's so current. She goes on to, it's like overhearing a conversation between all these moms judging each other. But what I really love about it is that I feel like she treats all of them with compassion, because what it's really talking about is how completely overloaded modern American parenting is with all of the information, and we almost don't know what to do with it. And so we latch on to whatever it is we're doing or we think we're doing, and then perhaps some of us might be judging other people's choices at the same time. But I mean, there's no way I can describe it to you. You've got to read it. Jenny's a New York Times bestselling author, which we do have, like Jennifer Weiner's in this book. There are some really notable authors, but the heart of Listen to Your Mother are often people who don't consider themselves writers, who have never been on stage before. But like you said, Veronica, it's like the story is so important and it's kind of almost pressing and present on their heart. And then they see an audition sign and it just compels them to take a risk and do this.
We've got a caller. Let's go to Gordon in Chicago, Illinois. And you can join us, too, at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What story do you want to get off your chest about your own mother or about being a mother? Gordon, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. You're coming through loud and clear.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Forgive me for some of the sound in the background. The specific story I have to share about my mother, because you asked us on the phone, and I've actually never called in to do something like this, so thank you for taking my call. The memory I have of my mother most specifically was sitting down with her in Tucson, Arizona, on her back porch, and somehow the discussion about my dad was coming up, my father, and her sort of hating him, and myself having that same hatred. And here's the interesting piece, is that somehow that conversation turned to my mother starting to well up with tears, and I kind of had a sense of maybe what was coming. And she said, you know, I had to be not only your mother and deal with all the stuff that was, you know, you as a boy becoming a man, but I also had to be really your father in a lot of ways too. And she started to sob. Now, what does that have to do with motherhood? Well, what it reminds me is that she had to understand how to be in the role of a mother, and in the best way she could, take on the role of being a father. And I held her hand, and let me tell you, it's one of the most intense things. I don't know if it's because of a son and a mother, but holding my mother's hand and watching her sob about this ripped my heart out. But I can remember her incredible strength for her willingness to talk about such a thing, and the joy that I had in her being willing for me to be there for her. That's my story. It was very touching.
That's very powerful, Gordon. Did that happen when you were grown?
Yeah, I think I was probably, I'm going to say probably 42 years old, somewhere around there, I'm just going to guess.
So it took a while to get to that conversation. Thank you for sharing that, and thank you so much for calling for the first time. We appreciate that, too.
Thank you so much.
And, that conversation happening later on, maybe not until everybody was ready for it. What do you think about a story like that between a mother and a son?
Well, Gordon's like the perfect example in a couple of ways. Him saying, I've never called in before. For some reason, this project, that's what it does. People sitting in the audience, they immediately go to their memory and start writing or telling their story, like while they're still sitting in the audience or while they're hearing about it. So I meet people and they immediately tell me their stories, which I love. The other thing is it's a really neat thing here in the Madison Show, which our Madison Show is on Mother's Day at the Barrymore at 3 o'clock. We do see adult children with their parents come to the show together. And I think it's a sweetness that comes in adulthood where our parents can, you know, feel okay about sharing things that you don't want to burden a child with. And I think it's a really neat part of aging that maybe people don't expect, an opportunity to have a different relationship with your parent or your child.
And you said that a lot of the people in the show, in the book, are, some of them are famous writers, but a lot of them are people who just have a story to tell that's pressing on them. Can you tell us about one of those people?
Sure. One that comes to mind is Lisa Allen, who talks about her dad, who really raised her. He was a sheriff's deputy, and as was pretty custom when she was growing up, probably in the 80s, I think she's about my age, is custody often went to the mom, which it did at first, but then it really should have been with the dad. And Lisa did a Listen to Your Mother show in Kansas City, and her piece is in this book, and there's a lot of really fine writers who you don't necessarily know their names, but they have been blogging for years, and her story is very tender, and I think a lot of people will relate who didn't have that relationship with their mom that was their primary caretaker, but it was somebody else, like the dad or a grandma or an aunt or an uncle.
And you've been doing this event now all over the country. What are some of your most powerful memories from these events?
I'm still so in the middle of it. I mean, taking my mom with me to our first New York show was in 2012 was beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And, oh, boy, I mean, I've gotten to see shows in the Twin Cities, in Chicago, in D.C. I mean, the heartbreaking thing for me is they're all clumped together in 2 weeks, and because I still do a show, I can't begin to get to all of these events. And I just love, as much as I love to do my own show, to just sit in the audience and listen is really an incredible experience.
Well, this has evolved a lot for you since those early days when you felt so isolated. What do your kids think now that their mom has launched a book and this national event that has become so popular?
I think they're warming to the idea. I didn't really prepare them very well when this whole thing took off, pretty much because I had no idea it was going to happen myself. So they went from sort of finding themselves on the cover of the State Journal in like kindergarten and younger, you know, and wanting nothing to do with it, to they just came, we went as a family to the book launch in Brooklyn last month, and they seem really pretty proud, and I loved watching them listen to the stories, and I think they're going to come and be in the audience this year. It's really not for kids. It's a PG-13 kind of experience, so for some kids, you know, it works, but it's not really a kids' show, but it's been really neat to see my kids kind of warming to the whole thing.
Well, Anne, thank you so much, and happy Mother's Day in advance.
Happy Mother's Day to you, Veronica, and thank you both for having me on the show.
We've been talking to Anne Imig. She's the founder and national director of Listen to Your Mother, and now a new book of essays by the same name called Listen to Your Mother, What She Said Then, What We're Saying Now.
There's more to come here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.